Blog Talk Radio.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world better than if you can.
Hello, Blog Talk family. Aisha, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am.
Okay, would you introduce yourself first as a host?
Yes, hello, world. My name is Asia Grace. My radio name is Asia Grace Gaskin. I'm 19 years old. I attend Rutgers University, and there I am a DJ on 90.3 The Core, as well as a television host for the morning show Wake Up Rutgers. Well, I'm very happy to be here today.
Great. We're glad to have you as our new host and our guest today. Are
Hello.
You on the line?
Yes, I am.
Okay. All right. Aisha, you want to take over?
Sure. Well, hello, Ms. Davis. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. So I know we're going to speak today about the Underground Railroad and your work with furthering everyone's knowledge about that.
Yep.
Okay, great. So why don't we begin with speaking about what's going on with the discussion you'll be holding about the Sojourner Truth Technology Center.
Okay.
Can you give me more information about that?
Sure. I teach at Adrian College in Adrian, Michigan, which is in southeastern Michigan, about 70 miles southwest of Detroit and 35 miles southwest of Ann Arbor. We're also about 10 miles north of the Ohio border. And Adrian is a small community. The county of Lenawee, which it is in, is about 152,000 people, 200,000 people. The work here, I'm from Lenawee County, and always, as growing up in Adrian, we always knew the names of various people like Aunt Laura Haviland, and other people who were abolitionists in the cause of freedom, people who were enslaved. And as I moved back to Lenawee County after some time in Africa and Europe and things, I began teaching in, I mean, political science and politics and public policy, and started teaching a course on the Underground Railroad and other flights to freedom with one of my coworkers at Adrian College. And in the process of that, I was also helping to try to pass legislation, part of the Michigan contingent, trying to get national legislation passed to both recognize, document, and disseminate information on the Underground Railroad and the abolitionist movement, which is one of the most important parts of the United States history. And from that sprang the Sojourner Truth Technical Training Center. I was teaching political science, chairing the political science department, then also doing this initiative on the side to develop a way to document and disseminate information on the Underground Railroad in Michigan. So that evolved from a kind of a little project into its own center. And subsequently, 3 years ago, we changed the name. It's a nonprofit organization, but it's called the Underground Railroad Education Program, whose focus is to both document, disseminate information, as well as to educate youth as well as adults about this, what is really the nation's first civil rights movement in America.
Okay, great. Well, can I ask you, why is the Underground Railroad relevant today to people in college, people who are learning more about African-American history? Why is that part of it so relevant to us today in 2010?
Well, I think one of the things is that we have all been miseducated about our history. When I'm saying we, I'm African-American, part Native American, part Mexican, part white. People who are white have been miseducated. And we've all been miseducated about the history of how America itself was developed and built. And I think it's just a time where a lot of effort has gone on both the national level, particularly some individuals and groups, to try to bring really the story of this history to the fore. I think it, while we hear and learn a lot about the negatives of slavery, there's obviously nothing good about slavery itself, but the story that they don't tell is how people fought it, and how people survived, and how people used all their wits without the use of computers or fax machines or automobiles, how people were able to fight and overcome and dismantle the system. It's a story that we all need to know about in terms of courage, in terms of faith, and crossing artificial boundaries as well.
You're right. I'm taking a course as well at my school,
mm-hmm.
and it's Black History in America, and it tells, you know, the different forms of resistance and different
mm-hmm.
things, you know, they had to do to survive the institution of slavery. So I do
mm-hmm.
believe, I do agree with you, it is important to know, you know, where we came from.
Right.
And, you know, the struggles they had to endure to get to get free, to at least survive and live and still, you know, have faith in God and all these other things that, you know, could have brought them down.
Right.
Well, can I ask you, I know that you own an Underground Railroad farm, correct?
Our family does, yes, we do.
Oh, your family does. Can you tell us more
mm-hmm.
about that?
Well, my grandfather moved from Detroit to Adrian in 1928, I believe, just before the crash. And he they were living in Detroit. My grandparents on my mother's side both came from Tennessee. And they moved to Detroit, and he worked, you know, with the Great Black Migration to the North is what they were part of. And their house burned down, and he was working as a tailor part-time and with a Jewish gentleman. And when their house was destroyed by a fire, my grandfather asked this gentleman who he worked with part-time, you know, if he knew of any property, because, of course, at that time, for blacks to buy property was not an easy proposition at all. He would have this gentleman buy property in Detroit for him, and then the white Jewish gentleman would turn the property over to my grandfather. So he was able to buy a lot of property in Detroit. And then for other family members and people coming up from the south to the north, he would, you know, they would have homes and stuff to live in and rent. So when their house burned down, he asked this gentleman to help find a property. And this gentleman found this farm out in Adrian. It's about 80 acre. It was an 80 acre spread with a house and barns and everything. And my grandfather came down to look at it and liked it and moved the family down there. It's an old Victorian house. And when my grandparents died, they determined that, you know, their will was that this farm should never leave the family. So when they died, passed away, it went to their children. And then as each of their children passed away, their grandchildren were dead. Take ownership. So when my mother passed away, my grandparents passed away, then it became all jointly owned by the nine children of my grandparents. And, for example, when my mother passed away, then all five of us also became part owners. My grandparents always wanted someone in the family to be able to stay in the home, we would kind of trade off who would live there. So my brother, I think, was the first one. My younger brother was the first one to move in there after my grandparents died. And he stayed about 7 years. Then one of my cousins did. And when I came back from Africa, I said, you know, I want to be next on the list. So when my cousin was ready to move out, I was getting ready to move into the home. And my aunt just shoved me some papers and said, here's some papers you need to have. And I kind of glanced through them at first, and then I started looking deeper into them and realized the home was much older than any of us had known it was. It was built back in 1844. And then when I started looking at some of the names, I started doing research on the property and found that the owners were abolitionists. And through the research on some of the other people who had held mortgages on it, found that a lot of them were involved in the abolitionist movement. And fortunately, a reporter I knew did a story on my research, and one of the descendants of the person who had built the house came forward and verified that her great-great-grandfather built the house and that they were active abolitionists on the Underground Railroad. So from that, I was able to, both between documentation and through contact with this woman, to verify the house. And it also explains some of the quirks of the house that we had, like a kind of a trap door in our living room, in the living room that was usually covered by a carpet, but that you could get into other parts of the basement. And there were other quirks in the house that, made sense, once I was able to research and determine that this actually had been part of the Underground Railroad movement.
Now, Hello, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. No, I can.
Oh, sorry about that.
No problem.
Do you know if that method that your grandfather or your grandparents used in order to purchase a house, was that common? Or do you know that that was the norm back in the day with, African-Americans?
I think that there probably were people that had built up relationships like that, but I don't think it was necessarily the norm. And, it was a time... when they were growing up, it was not legal for black people to buy property, even, here in the North. So this good man that my grandfather worked at Chrysler at the time, and because of his skin color, he was allowed to run the elevator type of thing. And he worked for this tailor part-time, and he just, as a good person, wanted to be of help to my grandfather. And to tell you the extent of that, now the home, when my grandparents bought it in 1928, it wasn't allowed to be in their name.
Right.
But to tell you how, faith and just also good intentions, the home had been owned by the Quaker Church.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather paid cash, put down, I think he just made two payments, purchased the entire property for about $3,000. In two payments. It didn't go into their name until 1945, after the end of World War II, like 1946.
Wow.
So from 1928 to 1946, my grandfather, grandmother, my mother, and then subsequently all the nine siblings lived there without a problem, went to school, did everything, and the name was put in the name of someone else who was white. During that whole time, because he couldn't hold property as blacks. And, imagine doing that today and living in a way where people, like the abolitionists, were stepping out doing what they could, the right thing. I think it's kind of the same thing that this man and these women, men and women, did, who were white, and as their way of helping for people to have equal opportunity. We're doing this type of thing.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. Now, you mentioned abolitionists and Quakers, and can you just explain what, who those people were and the roles they played in African-American history, and, give a little background on, the spirit of an abolitionist and what their purpose was, what their role was in, the progression of African-Americans in America?
Well, I think it's quite complex. I know we hear a lot about the Quakers, and we hear who still to this day believe in equality of treatment and a lot they practice what they profess, not just professing it, and Methodism and things like that. But there were all many religions involved in the movement towards freedom, as well as people of African descent themselves. I know when we were growing up, it was the impression we were given was that, here us poor Africans were just there in slavery, and these whites helped with the freedom movement. Well, it wasn't really quite like that, While there were a lot of whites that helped, there were blacks. On the African side, there's an underground railroad movement on the African side. And even as people were being brought over in the horrific conditions on the slave ships, people sometimes would jump overboard rather than to put themselves in that condition. People were trying to free themselves here. And Native Americans became involved. The Seminole War was fought over because of the Seminoles hiding escaped Africans. And the Seminoles integrated Africans in their community, as well as other Native American communities, whereby you have, a lot of African Americans who are mixed Native American as well in their heritage. You had Muslims, you had Jews, you had people of all types of backgrounds and religions and races who, did whatever they could do to stepped out of their own needs to do what was best for the cause of freedom. And I think sometimes that it's really quite a story of where, change happens when people do the extraordinary. And this was the case of that, where you had people sacrificing their own personal needs, their own personal safety, their own personal property for the cause of what they believed in. And in that, they changed the course of the nation. So what you had was, the Quakers in Michigan, like in Lenawee County, were the Quakers and the Methodists were very active. It's a county where the first abolitionist movement in Michigan was founded, possibly the first one in the United States, was founded by Aunt Laura Havland Elizabeth Comstock, a noted poet, and they actually were Quakers who got kicked out of their original Quaker church because they were considered so radical. The Quaker church believed in freedom, but Laura Havland and about 50 other fellow Quakers thought that not only should they talk about it, they need to do something about it, not just talk, but be active in helping the cause of freedom. And for that, they were kicked out of their original Quaker church and started the Hicksite Quakers Church, or another Quaker church, or the Friends Meeting Houses, and started their own church in Mass. And all of the people of that church were very involved in freedom, some even going into the South to free people, some providing safe houses here, others providing, or Laura Havland herself helping to make what the roots were throughout Michigan. Active all over Michigan, noted in Canada and in America. She had $3,000 bounty on her head back in the 1800s. So you're talking about people who risked their lives. They could have lost everything for their participation.
Now you mentioned black abolitionists. So mm-hmm. I know that there are a lot of key black figures that we hear mm-hmm. about day to day, like mm-hmm. Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, and I know that they are important. But are there other ones like such as William Stilt that we don't necessarily hear about every day? Were you mentioning?
Right.
Were you referring to them when you?
Right. There are other people. There are many other people who were involved in this. We hear about the main names, but we also need to hear about the other names, the other heroes. And that's one of the things I promote people is researching their own family history. When I have students in a college class, and was teaching the Underground Railroad and Other Flights to Freedom, first thing we wanted them to do is research your past. Everybody has a hero in their family.
Mm.
Somewhere in their family is a hero, whether it was the person who helped survive the crossing to the Americas. Maybe there was someone who, in your family, who helped make a neighborhood better. But everybody has a hero in their family. And, you know, people are surprised at some of the history they find. You had people who were in the South who were slaveholders. Say the husband was a slaveholder, but the wife was against slavery.
Right.
And she would quietly teach the enslaved how to read, which was illegal, how to write, which was illegal, or help people escape. You had children who were raised by the black slave mother, slave on the plantation, grew up with the black slave children. They were white, but couldn't understand the dichotomy of, I grew up with this child as a friend, and now I'm supposed to be, that person is supposed to be their slave. And you have stories of them escaping or helping to free, you know, the youngsters that they grew up with when they became older. So
it's very, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That's a very powerful premise that, you know, everyone has a hero in their family. And obviously with your family owning property and, you know, being able to have that, you know, back in the day, that was a humongous feat. But did you find one specific hero in your family when you retraced your history?
There were several heroes in my family, I would say. Well, my grandfather and grandmother were both heroes to me. My grandfather and grandmother, my grandfather was quite active in self-development of the African community in Detroit. He was quite active in that. Even back in the, you know, when he was, they were living in Detroit and they bought the farm, he was commuting by train to Detroit to work. So they had train, you know, regular train service. So he would work, take the train to Detroit on Sundays, stay all week, work, and take the train back on the weekends for home. And my grandmother ran a successful seamstress business out of the home and raising 9 children, plus the farm and leasing out areas of the farm, plus their own vegetables and things we were raising. And, you know, my grandfather had always wanted to be a medical doctor. He wasn't able to meet that dream. He was able to go to Meharry Medical College and attend Howard. But he was never able to completely meet that dream of becoming a medical doctor. But he always instilled education in us. My grandmother, I didn't find out till I was an adult that my grandmother was only educated to the 3rd grade, smartest woman I'd ever want to know, and was my encouragement in life, and ran a successful seamstress business from the home. My father, on my father's side, his people escaped slavery in Brazil, and they traveled all the way up from Brazil through Central America. Had this little stopper in Mexico, which is where the Mexican comes in the family, and grandfather's name Gomez, so no, you can figure that out, and came into Texas, founded some towns in Texas. We still have a family, basically a family-run town, a couple of family-run towns down in Texas. One outside of Dallas, owned a college, university, HBCU in outside of Dallas. You know, we have, you know, people on my grandmother's side, my father's side were educators, you know, going way, way, way back. On my grandmother's side of the family, they were, you know, her father was Native American and white. Her mother was black and Native American. And the stories of her great-great-grandparents and survival of slavery is interesting, because we didn't find out the real story until after my grandmother died, because my grandmother always swore up and down there was never any slavery in the family.
Wow.
Because it was such a shameful thing then to admit that you were in slavery. You had families, you had people that were slaves in your family. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, my father was a Tuskegee Airman. My mother was a wonderful homemaker in terms of the family. She worked out of the house part-time a couple of days a week, but was always at home every day by the time we got out of school.
You have a whole bunch, an array of heroes.
We have a array of heroes in our family.
Have you ever considered, well, before I get into that, because I was going to ask you, have you ever considered or have you written a book?
I'm in the process of writing a book, actually. Yeah.
About your family?
Yeah.
Or in general. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. It sounds like you have a lot to write about.
Yeah.
A whole lot going on in Brazil,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
Usually, well, at least I have only learned, not only, but specifically learned about slavery in America, but I know that it did go on a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, Brazil. There's actually one of the things I want to go to every year in Brazil. I can't remember the month, but there's a little town called Americaville in Brazil, not too far outside of Rio de Janeiro. What happened when slavery was abolished in the United States, a lot of plantation owners went to Brazil. And there's one area called Americaville because so many of them settled there. And this was before slavery ended in Brazil. And the descendants, when slavery ended in Brazil, they still stayed there and settled there, and they were all mixed into the population. Well, the descendants come back every year.
Do you know when it ended in Brazil?
I can't remember the exact date. I don't remember the exact date. But it was in the, I can't remember when, in the 1800s when it ended, but it was after it ended here. It was after 1865. It was maybe, if I remember right, maybe the 1870s.
Okay. Nope.
Okay. But every year in this town, Americaville, there is a the descendants of these former slaveholders and then who had mixed in with the slaves and former slaves and the Brazilian population, they have a reunion every year there, still to this day.
Wow.
You know,
it's great that you were able to find out all of this about your family. I mean, genealogy's always been like a interesting thing to me. I've always wanted to learn how to, you know, dig back and find out things about my past, my ancestors. So where, if one was to do that, where would you suggest begin researching?
Okay. Well, one thing, I had a cousin that did a lot of the work, and then we also collaborated because I knew a lot of things about Africa, and so he wasn't able to connect with that. How from Brazil, he found something about Angola, but he, you know, but that's another story. Well, first thing you do is interview family members. Ask them simple questions. How did we get here? If whatever your, what's your hometown, for example?
My hometown, well, my family, I would say my father's side is Teaneck, New Jersey. That's where a lot of his family lived. That's where he was born and raised. My mother is from Harlem.
Okay. You know, one simple question is asking your family members, how did we get here?
See,
how did we end up here?
My father's side, he, a lot of his, the only surviving member on his side is my aunt, right? So that's where I kind of get caught up. I know that our last name is French. But as far as, you know, you have, you know, your family was coming through Central America, I would like to know, like, how to find out more about actually getting
data, yeah. Well, I'm saying that one of the things is asking questions, oral interviews, because a long time, you know, oral history had been put down a lot, you know, that it wasn't accurate. But, you know, you can always cross-check it.
Right.
And one way to start is asking the relatives that you have living, what do they know? And you might be surprised. I mean, I can tell you another story, for example. My father, who I know was raised in Omaha, Nebraska, in Kansas City, his birth certificate says Council Bluffs, Iowa.
Wow.
It's like, how come, why is your birth in Council Bluffs, Iowa? Well, the time that he was born in Kansas City, the black women, or Omaha, the black women were not allowed to have their babies in hospital.
Wow.
So women had to go across the border to Council Bluffs, Iowa. So they were born there, and then a few days later, brought back over to Nebraska. And that's a whole history there. You know, how did they get to Nebraska? I remember my father talking about, just asking him simple questions. Well, Dad, how did your people get to Nebraska? Where'd your parents come from? Where'd your, you know, grandma and grandpa come from? Well, how about their brothers? The farthest he could go back, I remember there was something about Central America, and that's as far back as my dad knew the history.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, this is from the time I was younger, asking questions, you know, and that's the first thing you check. There is a wealth of data available on the internet. The National Institutes of, not National Institutes, the not the Smithsonian, the Library of Congress. People have been led to believe that there aren't records, but remember, slaves were considered property, okay? There's a lot of records.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of records. So most African Americans have been led to believe that there's no records. But sit down and think about it. If we were considered property and we were counted like any hog, sheep, any other property, if we were considered that, we were counted. We were listed in census reports. There is data. You can go to some libraries and see the actual shipping records and the notes of the captain of the ship.
Mm.
You know? You can read their notes. Like, most ship captains on the slave ships only did it once because it was so horrible.
Right.
So absolutely horrid. But they made a lot of records because they had to account for the cargo that they had.
Mm.
So, you know, that's why I say the first thing to do is talk to whatever living relatives that you have, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Asking them any bit of information you can get from them of who was here, who was there, where did grandma, where, any questions, first starting, how'd you get here? And once they describe where they get here, ask, okay, if you came from there, then how'd you get there? Well, who else lived there? Any names, dates, information, those are keys that then you can link up with other research.
What about the Bible or like...
Yes, the Bible is,
the Bible
is actually... Mm-hmm, Bibles are incredible sources of information.
Really? How so?
Because if, like, our family, my grandmother, our Bible, the family Bible, she lists not only their current children, but their sisters and brothers when they were born, aunts, uncles, other relatives are listed in that Bible.
Wow. I didn't realize people list their family members in the Bible.
Yes, yes. In the back, and particularly the older family members. So our family Bible has, you know, basically a what we would know as a modern day genealogy chart. You could sure plug that in and get a genealogy chart.
Is that so? That's the significance usually, just to have a genealogy chart in the Bible.
Right. Yeah. They used to. They would list the names of, you know, like my grandmother, for example, listed her mother's name, her father's name, her mother's sisters and brother's name, her grandmother's name, her great-grandmother's name, her father's name, his family members, their current children, my grandfather's name, his parents' names, his siblings. Yeah, and then on forward, down to their current children, their children's children, listed in the Bible.
Well, what about other things like funeral programs, military
yep.
records,
newspaper,
weddings?
Yep, all of that counts things. Because any data point you can use, you can also research marriage and death records and census data.
Wow.
And with the beauty of the internet, a lot of that you can look up online.
Right. That's what I had a project do, and I ended up using a lot of information online, finding out more than I probably would have.
Yeah, because people are led to believe that black people, because we were enslaved, that we don't have any information or any history.
Right.
I mean, my cousin that started the family research, for example, he, one time I went to visit him down in Austin, met his mother for the first time, and he's like, her name is Olinka. I'm like, Olinka? Like that? He's like, yes. And I met her. She was 90-something years old.
Wow.
And I'm like, where is your name from? She's like, she didn't know, and she started talking a little. I'm like, but that's a West African name. Because I knew I had lived in Africa, and I knew kind of the etymology of some of the names. And I knew her name was West African because it was Olinka. I'm like, probably around the area of Nigeria, Sierra Leone, but that is a distinctly West African name. And he started researching out that and asking her questions and found out more about her history on, you know, her side of the family.
It's amazing that just with a little bit of, you know, information, you can find out a whole lot. You can find
yeah.
out, you know, actual origins and things that you never thought you had
right.
access
right.
to. But we're, sadly, even though we're having a great discussion, we're down to our last 15 minutes. So let's talk
sure.
about your legislative work and the Freedom Trail
mm-hmm.
and more about that. Can you tell
okay.
us a little bit about your legislative work and the Freedom Trail?
Back in the 90s, there was a gentleman on the national level, Mr. Vincent DeForest,
who was very, who headed the National Park Service's community. He was a special assistant to the secretary of the Park Service, and he was for community outreach. Well, he got a lot of information collected and did a lot of research on the Underground Railroad, and he made it his mission to get legislation passed to help preserve, you know, some of these sites. Like our family home, you know, we're very fortunate, but we're only maybe one of two or three African Americans in the country who actually own an Underground Railroad related home. I was shocked. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely shocked. And so he, in terms of preserving this heritage, this important part of our national history. So what he did was people in different states that were friends that supported what he was doing also helped push and work for pushing this legislation. So there was a group of about 15 of us in Michigan who pressured our congresspeople, you know, both state and national, who wrote up things, involved in conferences and meetings, anything we could do to help support this. He got the legislation written up and for us to get passed and funding to help support the organizations that were, you know, researching the Underground Railroad. And this legislation did get passed, I believe, in 1998, 1999. And essentially what the legislation is about is that it puts in law and policy for the first time, recognizes the important part of this nation's history and how we have to preserve this history, have to recognize the importance of oral history, as well as disseminate and protect property, peoples, and places and events related to the Underground Railroad. And from that legislation then evolved the National Network to Freedom, which is to provide trails as well as research and conferences and financial support where possible to organizations. Michigan was the second state to pass its own legislation, Freedom Trail Commission, to also the same thing. It said basically the same thing as the federal legislation, that we must promote, protect, preserve, and disseminate information on the Underground Railroad, and seeks to document stories, peoples, places, and events in Michigan that have to do with the Underground Railroad and the people involved in the movement to freedom. So that's in general what it's about. And you know, there's different groups and peoples around the country that have been involved in this, and it was, in the sense, it was a major breakthrough because, you know, a lot of it wasn't being talked about or to know about the stories of these peoples, black people escaping, knowing that their family members would be killed or
brutalized.
Well,
we actually have someone online on the line.
Great.
Jacob Morris, and he's trying to get legislation passed in New York for the Freedom Trail. So are you willing to discuss that process with him?
Sure.
Just give him like a little overview
okay.
of what's to come, what to expect, trials, tribulations.
Well, you know, it's probably going to be an easier process now than it was back then. First of all, you have to, I think, have a group of willing people or people collaborating with you that can put together what the purpose is, what you want to achieve. Based on the way New York State government is organized, bringing forth the language to have something like that place. Now, you know, utilizing lobbying key or supportive state government members and Congress, state legislative members to move it ahead. Ours came under the Department of History, Arts, and Libraries. Was the focus where our Freedom Trail was based, the department that was responsible for, and the governor actually appoints the members of the Freedom Trail Commission.
so it's part of the policy legislative process. And, you know, I think it requires collaboration both with people in your state and even outside of your state to assist in moving that forward. So I think you have to find, you know, a small group of people. I mean, there wasn't a lot of us working on it, you know. It wasn't a lot of us, but it was a lot of work. It took several years of work to move that ball forward, particularly finding legislative support, and then you have to also get both the legislature and as well as gubernatorial support to get something like that instituted.
Well, Jacob is on the line. Jacob, would you like to introduce yourself to the Blog Talk family?
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, how are you doing?
I've been enjoying the different things that you've been discussing and the way you've been discussing them.
Well, thank you.
Do you have any specific questions for her or things that she may have not covered just then that you, you'd like to know or get advice on, Jacob?
Well, I'll throw something in on why it's important and relevant, you know, this history. One of the things that tickles me about what you were talking about from your own personal reasons for this being so motivating for you was that you came at it through the pathway of abolitionism,
mm-hmm.
Even within your own family.
Yeah.
And actually, I found that to be, a fabulous, pathway. In terms of the Civil War itself and, you know, how it happened that it tore the country apart.
Yes.
The Underground Railroad, basically, you think about it, you know, slaves escaping, black people escaping from slavery,
mm-hmm.
gave the lie to the story that the South was putting forth, which was, which came about actually in a conscious way. And this story was initially invented
mm-hmm.
by John Calhoun.
Mm-hmm.
I think because he was irritated with John Quincy Adams.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And that story was that slavery was a positive good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely negative. You know, as a justification
mm-hmm.
for that, it's good for us to hold people in bondage.
Right.
We're doing them a good, you know, it's good for them.
Especially when you don't consider them humans, but three.
Yeah, I mean, now before that, you know, and that led up to. I mean, you see, I look at political abolitionism as really starting around 1821 after mm-hmm. The Missouri Compromise.
Mm-hmm.
I date the that particular period or chunk of American history from after the Missouri Compromise. There was, you know, slaveholders prior to that epical event, which divided the United States into, you know, what was okay for there to be slavery in and what was not okay.
Mm-hmm.
They never justified slavery as okay. It was an economic necessity. They justified it on the grounds of economic necessity, but they didn't think that it was morally okay. It was only after. And then along came Calhoun, and he didn't like feeling... he didn't like feeling guilty.
mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
You know, so and then here you got, you know, black people escaping from slavery. God, how could they dare to even do that? This is like, don't they know this is good for them to be slaves?
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. So, and the more black people escaped, the story of the Underground Railroad, this heroism, this of blacks and whites together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This
and Native Americans.
Right. I mean, the role of, you know, the whole Seminole War in Florida, you know, was based on blacks and Indians intermarrying, fighting together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that really, that was pretty successful for quite a while.
Yeah.
The overwhelming power of the state was countered in this way.
Right.
And it's really good to the way I made the case in Brooklyn with Abolitionist Place was I said resistance to slavery is reason enough to preserve. Evidence of resistance to slavery is reason enough to preserve.
Right.
And you know, you don't need a definitive connection to the Underground Railroad.
No, you don't. No, because I think the Underground Railroad sometimes gets misunderstood because the first law to fine people harboring or assisting runaway slaves was in 1642.
Right.
You know? So, way before the so-called
definitely
Underground
my kind
Railroad
of
stuff, you know. So, you know, we should always find ways to romanticize things.
Isn't history amazing?
No, it's not history. It's people and doing the schizophrenia. We always have to find a way to justify things we know are wrong.
That's it. That's it. You know, I mean... And even today you got Rove and Cheney justifying other stuff.
Revising
history in the process. So, you know, this keeps going round and round. You know, when they have a philosophy and a power structure that they want to
preserve. Say it enough and it'll be people will believe it's true. If you say it often enough, people will believe it. You know?
So what happened is, you'll get a kick out of this, good old New York State finally got an Amistad Commission up and running to an extent because, unfortunately, a majority of the commission members are just expedient political appointees, I'm very sorry to say.
Right.
But then I'm sure you're familiar with Amistad commissions in other states also, and their track records of lack of track records, including New Jersey. Which may be better than most. But anyway, so I said to myself, it was the fourth meeting of the New York State Amistad Commission, and I had this idea a while back, like years ago, that downtown New York City, downtown Manhattan, very concentrated, basically before the Civil War, it was New York City's Harlem. And it's honeycombed with underground railroad sites and sanctuaries and transit points and so on and so forth. And easy to do, you know, like what a Freedom Trail right downtown.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And you look at, you know, other Freedom Trails in other cities, and they're wonderful, and they draw people, you know, whether it's Boston or Baltimore. I mean, you know, there's plenty of examples.
Right.
And so I said to myself, let's try to get a resolution passed by the Amistad Commission calling for a Freedom Trail in downtown New York City. Not just for the whole state, but, you know, like a focused one you know, locations. And I did a little research, and Connecticut's Amistad Committee, in conjunction with one of the state departments, they actually did a Freedom Trail in Connecticut with locations
mm-hmm.
in 1996.
Good. Great.
And so I showed them Boston's Freedom Trail. I made a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So they got all nervous. It's really funny. So they said something about putting me on the resource subcommittee, but then nothing's come of it so far, but I'm working on it.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to have it happen. I mean, it would be a wonderful thing. It'd be great for New York City as well as for history. You know, but... you know what I think the underlying problem is? Bureaucrats can't teach history.
No, but you have to make them comfortable that this is...
Oh, therefore, they should not
be
allowed to control how history is taught.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, Jacob? I really hope I wish you good luck, and I hope that you succeed in all your endeavors. And Miss Davis,
right, Leslie?
I thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with us and discussing
us.
Your family and the research and work you've already done. And we'd love to have you back to discuss more things about the Underground Railroad.
Okay, and thank you for doing what you all are doing.
Thank you so much.
And I have to thank these wonderful ladies also.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure speaking to both of you, and I hope all is well.
Okay, thank you, and you have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right, thank you.
Wonderful speaking with you, Kim.
You too. You as well. Hope we can connect. All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Gist of Freedom. See you next Sunday.